Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. No other topic makes parents clutch their hearts more than teenage sexuality. With each passing generation, youth culture appears to be more and more sexualized. From Miley Cyrus stripping on stage to teens killing themselves after naked pictures of them get leaked. Are our kids unleashed? Are kids these days really more promiscuous than their older counterparts? Joel Best and Kathleen Bogle, authors of the book Kids Gone Wild, are here to try to separate fact from fiction. In the last 10 years, the shock and concern over oral sex parties and sex bracelets might reveal more about our paranoia than their actual behavior. Are our kids really sexting? Are your children having oral sex in bathrooms? Or is it your moral panic that's a little bit overblown? Joel, Kathleen, welcome to our show. So why don't we just kind of jump into it? And let me ask this question. What was your motivation for writing the book for you guys?
Well, I found a reference to sex bracelets, and I thought it was very strange. I had never heard of it before, and I went into class, and I said to my students, do you know what they're doing in England? They have sex bracelets. And my students said, oh, yeah, we used to have those in junior high school. And I thought, oh, something has passed me by. This sounds interesting, and it sounds kind of like a silly thing to worry about. So I thought I would start looking into it. And Katie has specialized in studying sexual behavior of young people, and we've been talking about collaborating, and I suggested she might find this an interesting topic, and we were off to the races.
Excellent. Could you tell our very extensive audience what sex bracelets are, and what do they mean, and what do they look like?
Well, sex bracelets come in all different colors, and the colors are supposed to signify different sex acts. And if someone snaps off the bracelet, the most common version of the story is that you're supposed to do whatever sex act corresponds with the color. Now, the colors actually vary in different versions of the story, what the colors supposedly mean. So we had some fun with analyzing that. But that's the basic premise of the legend.
Now, you said the legend. So are these bracelets actually worn throughout the country?
Oh, sure. They've been around since the 1980s, although the story that they had sexual meanings seems to have started in 2003. We can't find any reference before that. But they were popular, and they're often popular with elementary school kids, so that part of the media excitement around this was to tell parents that unbeknownst to them, their child was advertising availability for sexual behavior. And so it was a sort of shocking story.
And what was the range for elementary school kids of the colors of the bracelets, and what were the acts for elementary school kids? What are we talking about?
Well, the legend was that, you know, black often meant sexual intercourse, blue often meant oral sex, red meant lap dance. Some things were even kinkier than those. But the idea was that people were wearing the bracelets. What we're talking about as a legend is that there was some widespread sexual practice going on internationally. So we're not denying that people were wearing the bracelets, but we're denying that the sexual behavior of youth corresponds with what the legend says.
Okay, well let's take it a step back. We, as basically human animals, all animals, our sexual desires programmed into us to reproduce, to keep up the existence of the human race, or if it were any other species, it'd be the same thing.
Sure.
Why or how has the desire to be for sex as opposed to just intimacy and closeness, how has that changed in the last 1,000 years?
Oh, I don't think we have any idea how people behaved sexually 1,000 years ago. I think that we started studying sex maybe 100 years ago, and we don't have very good data from that period. So, we can find certainly. People were having sex, it appears in art, and so on and so forth, but there's no good way of knowing what ordinary sexual behavior was like until well after the Second World War.
Well, I've been doing executive life coach and neuroplasticity, which is medical hypnosis, for now it's 37 years.
Uh-huh.
125,000 patients later in 37 years, everyone has had feelings of sexual desire at a very, very young age, just even aware mm-hmm. of their sexuality, whether it was for self-pleasure or fantasy. I don't know whether or not that has probably changed forever. I think that society has dealt with it differently. I think that religion has dealt with it differently, and religion has had more power in certain areas in this country, in many areas it has less. In some it has, just as much as it always has. But I don't know if the desire for sex has changed because it's simply built into who we are.
Well, I don't think we know a lot, as Joel said, about the history of sexual behavior. We don't have great data on it. But we do know that how people think about childhood has changed throughout history. So even thinking of childhood as a distinct stage or a protected stage, or now even a prolonged stage, some say adulthood isn't at 18, that it's even later than that. There's this whole idea of emerging adulthood. So I do think that this idea that children are innocent and must be protected is a more recent invention than, as you say, sexual desire that's been with us probably throughout time.
Actually, Kathleen, I liked your choice of words. I think it is an invention. I think that, in fact, that children are they're less educated by their parents. Their parents are much... they refuse to bring up the topic, probably for the same old reason that their parents didn't bring up the topic. I was raised in a fairly liberal Jewish family where it was brought up. And, because of that, there were very little mistakes made, because everything was discussed and everything was open and nothing was taboo. Do you find that the lack of discussion from parents to children about the unique individuality of sexuality within a person? I think it's important to point out, from my perspective, and you guys tell me what you think, that you could have 2 5-year-olds. One could be sexually oblivious, and the other one could be, sexually incredibly aware and already masturbating.
Yeah, I think that what you see is this is part of the larger culture wars in our society. You've got one side, and I'm going to simplify this, but there's one side that is basically viewing childhood sexuality as a promise, as a danger, something that they would like to control. They would like to deny it. The ideal here is that children become sexual late and they don't actually act on those impulses until they become married and so on. And these are the folks that are often very frightened of having sex education programs in schools and such. On the other side, you've got people that are more inclined to say, well, sex is a natural part of growing up. It's normal. What we want to do is provide education so that young people can make good choices. And there's a tension within this. I mean, you get local school districts where people are fighting over what the sex education curriculum ought to be, and so on and so forth. And I think that when we get caught up in these fears about sex bracelets or rainbow parties or so on, we're tapping into those larger cultural themes.
So why aren't we addressing the underlying theme that children not only want to feel pleasure, but they also want to feel like they belong? I mean, remember the straight edge movement, where no sex, no drugs, no alcohol, was started by students. and that straight edge movement exists to this day. And the reason why it was so successful is these kids got to belong to something.
Well, we know from sociological research that American parents are very uncomfortable with the idea that their kids, even at older ages, even into teens or late teens, are sexually active. One sociologist has written a book titled Not My Kid, with the idea that people see other kids as a sexual threat, that the other kids are going to corrupt their kid, but they don't think of their kids as sexual. We also know from cross-cultural research that in other countries, parents are more comfortable with the idea that kids, when they're teens, might have a girlfriend or boyfriend, and sex may even happen in their house. And that's a very uncomfortable idea for American parents. So there's definitely that idea that you're talking about that we see through sociological research.
But Kathleen, if you ask any kid whether their parents have sex, they say no. Meaning no kid wants to think of their parents having sex, and no parent wants to think of their kids having sex. But guess what? Everyone's having sex. So the question
is
do we need...
that we survive as a species.
Right. So do we need to teach the kids, or do we need to teach the parents that, listen, this is a part of life, and just the way you don't drive a car or a plane at 7 years old, you don't have intercourse at 7 years old because you can't handle it.
Right. But I think that part of these urban legends and the whole idea of urban legends is that they start and they're perpetuated because there is an underlying fear. So, you know, my co-author who's with us today, Joel Best, wrote the famous Razor Blade in the Apple article, which is timely to think about with Halloween. And there was an underlying fear there of strangers, that strangers are going to give your kid candy that is poison. They're going to hurt your kid. They're going to slip a razor blade into the apple. And that was found to be an urban legend. But it showed what societal fears we have. So same way with this, the sex bracelet urban legend and the rainbow party urban legend show that people are really concerned about the sexualization of childhood, that kids are going to start doing things at younger and younger ages. And what's interesting to me is even when I tell people, you know, we've studied this and these things are urban legends and there's not much truth to them, and the data doesn't support that kids have gone wild, they always say, well, you know, I think they have. I think they're different than ever before. I think they're having sex at younger and younger ages. And the data just doesn't support that concept.
No, I agree with your data because, I mean, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and there was probably more sex going on then than there is now. I think that there was a difference in the understanding of sex. I think there was a difference in the people and the way they related to one another. They were just honest about it. They weren't trying to kind of, you know, create a pseudo relationship. Very often they were friends who were just hooking up. But I think what happens now with sex, I think now the real danger is children are being bullied into sexual acts. I think the real danger is that children are more and more cruel to one another. And that I think is an urban legend. I think it's an urban fact. It is very, very hard to find schools where severe bullying doesn't occur, even and especially among the very elite schools. And part of that bullying is, have you done this? Why haven't you done this? Who have you done this to? So I think that's a big part of it.
Well, I was going to say, it seems to me that you certainly have more knowledge. You know, the internet means that even very young people have some access. They know more about what sex is about at earlier ages, certainly than my generation did. I've asked classes of students, at what age did you first see an image of people having sexual intercourse? And typically they're tapping into that in sort of the middle years of elementary school. They know about this stuff in a way that I didn't, and I think most people my age didn't when I was growing up. So that's a change, and then that may make some difference in the resources that the kids have to talk about this stuff. I think that some of the things that are on the sex bracelet list were actually things that I had to look up. I wasn't quite sure what it meant. There's a lot of vernacular that's unfamiliar, and young people know this kind of stuff. The question is, does it actually translate into real sexual behavior? And there, the evidence is that, kids today are certainly less sexual than they were 20 or 25 years ago.
I don't have the statistics and I haven't looked at it. It doesn't appear that way living in New York City in terms of teen pregnancies and teens in terms of especially among minorities where condoms and contraception is not always used. But here's my concern. My concern is that parents who are supposed to be the counselors, the coaches, the embodiment of wisdom, if they cannot accept that kids will try to be intimate for a various number of reasons, and they will be intimate before they're married. If they can't accept that premise, how are we supposed to teach kids anything about reality when you're living in fantasy?
Well, I think that speaks to, what Joel said earlier about the cultural wars that have been going on a long time, that we see people on both sides, both conservative and liberal, who are having this tug of war over what kids are told. It also plays out with policy decisions, and we highlight that in the book about Plan B, should, people under 18 have access to it. Gardasil, should you have to get, a vaccination to avoid cervical cancer because of being sexually active. So it plays out in things that are very consequential. It isn't just, whispers and gossip about sex bracelet. It's also when it comes time to make a policy decision. Same thing with the sexting issue. Should we lock up kids who are sexting and put them on the sex offender registry, or should we treat this differently? How we think about kids and sex affects how we, write up policy about it.
Catherine, let me weigh in about the sexting. Kids, young kids who are 13, 14, who are sexting to one another should not be locked up and put on the sex offenders list, because this is what they would do before there was technology. They'd be talking on the phone, or before there was a phone, they'd be whispering in one another's ears. So sex offenders is when you have a 30-year-old, trying to seduce a 5-year-old, not a 12-year-old flirting with a 13-year-old.
Yeah, I think Joel and I would agree with that, because, part of what we pointed out in the chapter on sexting is that there was a lot of hype around it, and because people have such extreme ideas of what kids today, these kids today are supposedly doing, that they panicked a bit when it came to the sexting issue and said, what are we going to do? We've got to crack down on this. We've got to lock them up. We've got to, show them that there's lifetime consequences. And when researchers actually looked at the issue more carefully, they said, a lot of what's going on here is, a boyfriend and girlfriend sending one another, some suggestive pictures. Why are we trying to throw people in jail, or why are we trying to give people a felony record over that?
Well, that's a good point. Why do we have the largest percentage of our population in jail than any other country? That's an excellent point. Is because that government can't just mind its own business and realize that national security, is really the issue. But let's go back to your topic rather than me rant. Do you believe, either one of you, that someone is going to reach the age of puberty without having any sexual feelings, desires, or the pressure to go ahead and experiment?
Well, personally, I don't know about absolutely everybody, but I think that virtually everyone certainly is going to have some sexual impulses, some sexual feelings, and there's going to be a tremendous range in how that gets expressed and acted upon. But yeah, I think sex is part of who we are as an animal, and most of us are certainly have those feelings.
Now, Joel and Kathleen, do you guys have kids?
I do.
Joel does.
Joel, how many kids?
I have two adult sons.
Okay, and I have two adult daughters, 36 and 31. And how old are your sons?
32 and 28.
Okay, so when you were in the same group, what did you tell your kids about sex growing up?
Oh, I followed my father's example and told him nothing. But my wife had worked at Planned Parenthood, and she had a whole curriculum of sex education materials that were age appropriate that she would bring up all the time. So I think sometimes to their embarrassment. So I think that certainly we weren't pretending that sex didn't exist. They had sex education materials. They were, of course, invited. Do you want to talk about sex? And of course, they said what all children say when they receive that invitation: "No, thank you." But we were pretty open about it.
Right, but you know what? And it's funny what you said, that you did like what your father did is nothing, which is what most parents do. Is that why do we talk about sex before we talk about what the child really wants, which is acceptance, which is love, which is a feeling of belonging, a feeling of safety? You know, children are able to put off the urge to merge if they do receive a lot of affirmation in other ways. There are kids that literally are able to wait. I know a number of people who I've treated who literally waited to 18, 19, 20, 21, because they had such great relationships with their siblings, with their parents. You know, they were active, they had friends. They just had a lot of things that made them feel whole. Why are we not getting a little bit to the root of why kids have sex? The fact that when something is taboo, you do more of it.
Well, one of the things that I think is interesting in the book that Joel brought to the table was tracing throughout the 20th century how parents have been concerned about various things that suggest their kids are sexual. So it isn't just today with sex bracelets and rainbow parties. You know, he talks about, people being concerned about miniskirts, rock and roll, Elvis and the moving hips, lipstick, all of these kiss and chase games, all these things over time that parents at various points in history were concerned about with parents. So I think we see that it's not just today that parents are afraid to broach this topic, or afraid that, you know, their kids might have sexual ideas or be a sexual being. You know, we really see that throughout the 20th and 21st century.
Well, meaning what's happened is that the children's need for intimacy has always been there, and it's been expressed throughout history depending upon how much freedom the child was given. If children weren't allowed, you know, to play together or always supervised, yes, but that would normally come out later, you know, in some function. In modern Western society, since the advent of more and more knowledge, say for birth control and the understanding of how disease spread, the question is, you know, is sex something that is a harmless pleasure if you do everything that you need to do to prevent disease or pregnancy, or is it inherently emotionally dangerous? So I guess I want you guys to address that question. Can it just be pleasure?
I think that that's a very modern way to think about it. I think that as we have, particularly as the 20th century went on, and people learned more about sexuality and they talked more openly about sexuality, the idea of being comfortable that sex was about pleasure and not procreation, became more common. Now, obviously, we know from diaries and so on, historical documents, that people always found pleasure in sex. But to have a public debate about what is the purpose of sex, well, the purpose of sex is to produce the next generation. That's really what this is about, and so on. So I think that we're trying to take sort of a modern way of looking at this and pushing it back into time and imagining that people always talked in those terms. I don't think they did. I think that this is a relatively recent development. I think there was a great deal of silence and shame and discomfort in earlier periods about surrounding sexuality. I'm not saying that everyone felt that way, but I think that that was, you know, there was a certainly among the emerging middle class in the 19th century.
I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. The problem is we are in the modern age, and we need to go back and take a look at history and address the issue that making sex something for just procreation's sake is not only unrealistic, but it creates unnecessary guilt and shame, which presents problems for the parents, for the children, for their relationship, and for their children.
I was just going to say one thing I know from my first book on hooking up, that when you look at the kind of standards throughout history for, you know, what is the context for what sex is supposed to be. So there was this idea that it was supposed to be marriage only. And then it kind of loosened a little bit that, like, well, if you're engaged to someone, you're going to marry, you know, sex is okay then. And then you kind of hear people articulate, well, if you're in love with someone. And when I ask students today, well, what is the standard now? They really have trouble articulating what the standard is. And we know that throughout history, of course, not everyone lived up to the standard. You know, Kinsey's research, of course, is going to show that. But I think there's a lot of confusion today about what the standard is. So I don't think mine and Joel's book, you know, we are not psychologists who are advising parents on what to tell kids. But what we can do as sociologists is say, no matter what religious background, no matter what your values are, there's a lot of false information out there about what kids are doing. And that means kids are making decisions based on false information. So, you know, again, from my first book, you know, I interviewed people who said, well, I got rid of my virginity because I didn't want to be known as one, because there, you know, there aren't any virgins. Well, 25% of college students are virgins nationwide. So it's not a matter of us advising be a virgin or don't be one. It's a matter of us telling people and telling parents, you know, let's have kids make decisions based on accurate information about what's really going on, not this false sense of rainbow parties, sexting, and kids gone wild.
Correct. But the only problem is, Kathleen, kids don't make they don't make decisions based upon information. They make decisions based upon emotion. They make decisions based upon whether or not they're going to feel shame and disgust, or whether or not they're going to feel pleasure and acceptance. It's not information that drives decisions. It's for young people, it's emotions.
Oh, I think that there's a very there's a lot of things. I mean, you may not be calling this information, but what Katie's trying to say, I think, is that you have a sense of what's going on. You have a sense of what other people do. You have a sense of are people shamed and ridiculed, or is their behavior tolerated, et cetera. So I think that we're scanning the world. It's not just how do I feel, what would I like to do right now, but we're also looking around in the social environment and saying, what is it that other people are likely to think? How are people likely to treat me, depending upon what I'm trying to do? And, you know, that's also, I mean, partly that can be feelings of shame or guilt, but it's also going to be partly a sense of, are other people going to think this is okay? I could probably do this if people wouldn't think there was anything wrong with it, et cetera, et cetera.
But Joel, have we broken it up into different religions, different cultures? I mean, the French and the Italians have a different way of looking at sex, than the Irish. I mean, or the Hasidic Jewish. I mean, meaning, what are we talking about when we talk about attitudes? I mean, is it possible to talk about sexual education when there's some groups that refuse to even consider not even touching another person until they're married?
Yeah, I don't think anyone is ever going to convince parents that come from a particular background. So if someone is a strict Christian in a part of the South where they think that you need to wait until marriage. You know, nothing that anyone's going to say is going to convince them otherwise. But we can look at what the research says, and we can look at, you know, people that take virginity pledges still tend to have sex prior to marriage. They just delay it later. You know, so what sociologists can bring to the table is what the data says, not necessarily, advice on what people should be doing.
Since I'm in the advice area, I'm going to make a statement that what I tell people is that sexual intimacy freezes emotional intimacy to whatever point it's grown. So the reason, and I am not, conservative in the manners of sexual behavior, I'm realistic, that if you don't grow a real relationship and there's not a real friendship, there's going to be a lot of fear and anxiety and competition and angst in the sexual act, and you're probably not going to reach a place where the sex becomes anything more than sex and not real, true intimacy that lends to a growing relationship. So I would tell people the same thing I told my kids. It's not a matter of that sex is bad. It's a matter of what does it do to the relationship emotionally if you don't build a solid friendship and a solid relationship under it.
Well, I think, you know, there is research about, you know, what is the context for the sex that's happening. And, you know, one of the things Joel and I found is that in spite of this idea that the context for kids is always this anonymous sex, you know, anonymous sex at a rainbow party, you know, the whoever snaps off the sex bracelet, that actually the context for most intercourse for young people is in the context of a relationship that's ongoing. So I think we sometimes picture it as more anonymous than it is. And I do think that it's dangerous for people to think that all these young people are having these anonymous encounters with random, strangers that they meet or someone that they barely know at school, when that isn't really what's happening. Because again, then people are making decisions, and you know, you can mix what we said about making decisions based on what they think other people are doing, what they think the norms are, with those emotional issues that you were talking about. But they still need to be making decisions based on something that's real, not a false perception.
Have you guys done any research on the connection between sex and alcohol and drugs? Because the truth of the matter is the 60s couldn't have happened if it wasn't for alcohol, you know, and drugs.
Yeah, I think the most important drug was the birth control pill, though.
I think it was pot and alcohol.
I've done some stuff about the connection between sex and alcohol, particularly when things can cross over to be a sexual assault. And the whole national discussion going on right now about sexual assault, I think, shows that not everything is as it appears in TV and movies going as smoothly as that. There's a lot of things where people are unhappy with what happened. People feel upset. People feel traumatized by what happened. And then the question becomes whether it meets the legal definition of rape or not. But my point is that alcohol is often heavily, heavily involved in a lot of those scenarios. So I do think that's something that we need to be talking to young people about.
Why rape, and why is there the assumption that the man is the one who's more of the sexual aggressor?
Well, I think that in terms of who comes forward and reports, we see more female victims reporting. So then the question is, well, are men, victimized and not reporting, or is it just not happening? But I think the reason why it's often talked about in terms of male perpetrators and female victims is based on, you know, the cases that have come to light.
Well, most men wouldn't go to the authorities to report that, you know, some very attractive girl had sex with him. I think he would be, singing a lullaby to himself for the next few weeks. So he's not likely to say that. I think that a woman might say it because of shame and guilt, or feeling that she might get in trouble, or if something happens, she has someone to blame. I'm not saying that it doesn't happen, meaning sexual abuse happens all the time, and drugs and alcohol make it easier to cross that line. I think it's simply unfair to assume that it is always one gender's, it's always the male agenda who's the more sexually aggressive person. Even though I would say for the most part that that's probably true, I don't think it's always true.
Well, I think it's, again, a matter of how are we defining sexual assault? How are we defining rape? You know, Joel, in his famous book on Damn Lies and Statistics, looks at that issue of, you know, how are we defining an issue, and how we're defining it affects then, you know, what numbers we have, what, you know, what percent have experienced sexual assault depends on how we're defining it. So, you know, part of the issue that you might be raising is in what's getting counted, what people are thinking of as a sexual assault. And there's quite a bit of debate, as we see with a lot of the op-eds that have gone around nationwide, about what counts as rape.
Now, Kathleen, you haven't had children yet. What are you going to tell your kids about sex and when?
I don't know. I'll have to cross that bridge when I come to it.
No,
but,
let's cross it now. Okay? I mean, you've been studying it. You wrote a book. You're going to have children one day. What will you tell them?
I mean, I think that, again, the most important thing for me is that they're not making decisions based on false information. And I understand what you're saying, that there's an emotional dimension, et cetera. I think I would tell them that the context of how it happens matters a lot. And I also would tell them that they and their peers are under a lot of false impressions of what's going on out there. And, you know, we do see pressure on kids because of that. Speaking of the alcohol issue, when you ask incoming college freshmen, you know, how often does a typical student drink? They think, well, a typical student drink, you know, gets drunk every Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Well, that behavior obviously is going on, but when people actually research it, they find, well, there's about 20% of college students that do that, and there's 20% of college students that don't drink at all, and most are in between. And the point
nobody went to my college.
We don't want them making decisions based on, you know, this hyped idea that everyone is, you know, saying chug, 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 and everyone's getting wasted all the time. And I think the same thing applies to sexual behavior. It would be heartbreaking to think, you know, my child or any child in my life is making a decision based on, well, everybody else is doing it, so that's what I have to do.
But isn't the statistics irrelevant? Isn't the relevancy the cause and effect of an action? Why an action could be positive because it's going to create positive results. Who cares who's doing it? If 999 people are doing something out of 1,000, what they're doing is harmful and destructive, it doesn't make it wrong for the 1% to do the opposite.
No, of course not. But I think that you can have a distorted vision of what is happening. I think that you know, I agree with Katie to provide good information, because good information helps people have a context within which they can make their decisions.
And as much as we would like to think, you know, people all make individual decisions, you know, go on any college campus and look at how many people are in a North Face jacket. Look at how many people over the past few years are wearing UGG boots. You know, they might say, well, that's my personal style. But they are making decisions based on what they see around them, based on what they believe their peers are doing. And I think that plays out with choices about alcohol and drugs. I think that plays out with decisions about sexual behavior. So I'm not suggesting that they're sitting there, you know, saying this percent do this and this percent do that. But they have a sense of, well, what are people like me? What are people like me doing? Where do I want to fit into the scheme of things? And, you know, we see with athletes, we see with fraternities, some of the problematic behavior, you know, is somewhat contagious among those groups of people. So I do think we have to think about who they're around, who they're exposed to, and what they believe is normal.
European children, well, Western European children, have sex much more often than teenagers from the United States. Do you think they're less stable or more stable for their choices?
Oh, I don't have an opinion about that. I don't know how to measure stability, and I don't know... I don't know what the data show. I'm just going to pass.
Yeah, I don't know. The only thing that I know is that in terms of differences between the U.S. and Europe, that the kids are just as sexually active, but less likely to get pregnant. So I do think that that is worth, you know, looking at why we're different with contraceptive use than other countries are, if it is because of sex education issues or if there's other reasons why that is.
Right. Well, I want to thank you both, for coming on the show. I appreciate your book. And we're going to encourage everyone to pick up a copy of it. So thank you for everything. Bye now.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
I want to once again thank Joel and Kathleen for coming onto our show. Pick up a copy of their book, Kids Gone Wild, on Amazon today. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, and remember, to every problem there is a solution. Please check out our other episodes at gluckradio.com. Keep listening and keep sending in your feedback. You can also reach me at glucksolutions.com. Till next time.